Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I think what we have to do here is divide the American economy into two categories, before subprimes and after subprimes. And then we have to realize that economic indicators that date back before this summer, well, they just don't amount to a hill of beans anymore. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
From the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday today, the 27th of September, and it is, as always, great to have you with us. The economic indicator in question is on the A list of numbers that analysts look at. Gross domestic product. We learned this morning economic growth for the second quarter came in at a robust 3.8%. But David Weiss, chief economist at Standard & Poor's, says there's been a lot of water under the bridge since then.
This is not a very relevant number right now. It's old news. This is the second quarter. We're almost done with the third quarter. You know, this is before any of the subprime fallout, before any of these freezes in financial markets that we're worried about now.
Another thing economists are worried about right now is housing, and they are really worried about it. There was a report earlier this week that sales of existing homes have hit a five-year low. Today, the Commerce Department reported sales of new homes dropped more than 8% last month, a seven-year low. Home builders, as we've mentioned, are getting hurt, but Marketplace's Elisa Roth tells us that's not the only industry where we're going to see some ripples.
Ask economist Ian Shepherdson what he thinks of today's numbers, and he doesn't hold back.
We've now moved from correction to meltdown in the housing market.
Shepherdson is chief U.S. economist at High Frequency Economics.
New home sales are now down about 40% from the peak that they reached in the summer of 2005. And unfortunately, there's just no sign at all that that 40% decline is the end of the story. And there's plenty of indications that it will actually get worse.
Worse could mean the housing recession turns into a general recession. As people stop buying houses, home builders stop building them. Carpenters, plumbers, and others who work in the industry have less work or get laid off. Stephen Rick is an economist at the Credit Union National Association.
Because these plumbers and electricians and carpenters are not working, they are purchasing less goods and services from the community they live in.
The effect on local communities can be harsh, but the reverberations often extend beyond the city limits.
As home builders in your local community may be building fewer homes, that means the appliance manufacturer, say, down in Georgia, or the carpet mill that would have made carpets that went to the house, they're also laying off people.
Right now, the trouble's concentrated in a few parts of the country. Susan Wachter studies real estate at Wharton.
One are those that are suffering from general doldrums, economy. That's the old Rust Belt. Secondly, we had the parts of the country that really challenged by high housing prices. We're talking about the two coasts to a lesser extent, but also important, we have overbuilding in second home markets, condo markets such as Las Vegas.
And she says it's getting harder for people to borrow against their homes. Houses are worth less, and banks aren't keen to make loans against collateral whose value is dropping fast. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
One aspect of the credit market that hasn't really been squeezed the past couple of months is the plastic part. The Federal Reserve says we're charging as much stuff as ever on our credit cards. But a report out today from the consumer watchdog Public Citizen says that when we dispute some of those charges, cardholders lose almost every time. Helen Palmer reports.
I guess most of us don't actually read credit card agreements. If we did, Public Citizen's Joan Claybrook says we'd see we'd given up the right to sue in favor of binding arbitration.
The problem is that the hidden gotchas in credit card contracts are not only in dense legalese, but in tiny print. It's a system in which the credit card company holds, well, they hold all the cards.
Public Citizen's analysis of some 34,000 cases that went to arbitration in California shows that the card companies won 95% of the time. No surprise to Harvard Law professor Elizabeth Warren.
Arbitration sounds like the Andy of Mayberry way of resolving disputes. Cheap, folksy, and fair. In fact, it often becomes the Darth Vader's Death Star method of dispute resolution. The empire always wins.
Warren says that's because the credit card companies choose and pay the arbitrator. They pick those that rule for them. She says that gives arbitration companies, like the National Arbitration Forum, a powerful financial incentive to favor the card companies. The National Arbitration Forum wouldn't address these issues on tape. They did issue a statement saying, consumer outcomes in arbitration are the same as in court. Every published study indicates consumers prevail at a rate greater than or equal to litigation. The American Bankers Association also disputes Public Citizen's claims. It says arbitration is faster and cheaper than going to court. Its statement calls arbitration one of the fairest, most efficient methods for resolving complex disputes between consumers and businesses. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
Investors tried like heck to get something going on Wall Street today. Never did quite make it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Thanksgiving season football rivalries are a ways off yet, but we have the score from a Harvard-Yale game today. It's Yale 28, Harvard 23. We're talking investment returns here. Yale's take of 28% for its endowment puts it number one in the country for this fiscal year. Harvard was third in returns, although it does still have the largest endowment overall. Big university endowments like those score big gains a lot. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli takes us now inside their playbook.
Former Harvard CFO Alan Proctor says university and foundation endowments have some big advantages you don't have.
An endowment basically has an infinite time horizon. So if you had a bad year, you have decades to recover that money.
That means endowments can take on more risk than individual investors. They also have professional money managers. But Mark Ruloff of Watson Wyatt says that even talent plus time isn't the whole equation.
There's individuals with talent and resources. And even if the individual might have the talent, he as an individual wouldn't necessarily have the resources to outperform the market.
So you need talent, time, and billions of dollars to score like these mega funds. Alan Proctor says there's a message in that for small investors. Don't try endowment-level risks at home.
Absolutely. Except for an extraordinarily wealthy individual, an individual has to worry about it. If they had an investment that was tied up or needed 30 years to recover, it's one thing when you're 25 years old, but in your 50s, you can't even think about those investments.
A while back, Yale Endowment head David Swenson set out to write down how individuals could at least approach Yale's investment returns. He came away with the opposite conclusion. The vast majority of small investors can't do it, and it's dangerous to try. Swenson also says little guys are victimized by excessive mutual fund fees and advisors' conflicts of interest. His one-stop way to address all those problems? Low-cost, broadly diversified index mutual funds. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Wall Street's credit crunch has come to the world of student loans. Back in April, a group of investors agreed to pay $25 billion for the federally chartered student loan company Sallie Mae. Since then, of course, much of the financing for those big leveraged buyouts has dried up, and today we learned the potential buyers want to renegotiate their purchase price. Another thing that's weighing on their minds is a bill the president signed today. It'll pump another $20 billion into federally backed student aid programs, in part by cutting subsidies to lenders, which would affect Sallie Mae. Commentator Kim Clark says more money for college students is all well and good, but we ought to check the math on how we factor those costs in the first place.
You know how kids start cracking open algebra books and whining, "Why do I have to learn formulas? Nobody uses this in the real world." Well, listen up. There's a real-world formula gone so bad that it could cost you big bucks. That's the formula the government uses to determine how much your family should pay for college. It's got a lot of variables, but generally, a family of four living on more than $2,250 a month after taxes is expected to cough up money for college. How much money? At least 22 cents of every dollar above that budget. You coastal city dwellers can lift your jaws off the floor. I didn't make a mistake. The government did. Get this. Back in 1967, the government calculated the budget of a family with a lower standard of living. And for the last 40 years, they haven't adjusted it for the dramatic increases in expenses like health insurance, child care, retirement savings, or for regional cost of living differences. Consider the Brooklyn family lucky enough to find a decent two-bedroom for $1,200 a month. The government's own research shows that even stingy families would need at least another $2,000 for luxuries like food, transportation, utilities, health care, clothes. And that doesn't even allow a penny for child care, retirement savings, or, God forbid, a movie. Yet the government and colleges will limit grants to that student so that the family pays at least $100 a month for college. Congress just tried to solve some of this problem by increasing the budgets for students who are paying to put themselves through college. Nice try, but no help for parents. Wouldn't the textbook answer be to fix the formula by basing it on real families' real cost of living?
Kim Clark is a senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. If you've got some thoughts to share with us, send them along. Our website is marketplace.org. European Cancer Organization's meeting in Barcelona, Spain this week. Among the findings announced by researchers so far, that drinking any type of alcohol, not just hard liquor, can add to a woman's risk of getting breast cancer. The war on cancer has been going on for almost 40 years in this country, but author Deborah Davis says in her new book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer, that we're going about it the wrong way. Ms. Davis, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What's the secret here in The Secret History of the War on Cancer?
We've known for a long time what the causes of cancer have been, and we started the war against the wrong enemies with the wrong weapons, because when Nixon launched the official war on cancer in 1971, it was all about the disease and not about the things that were causing it. I mean, as an example, why did it take us so long to come to an agreement on the dangers of tobacco? We understand now that that had a lot to do with the politics and the economics of tobacco and not that much to do with the science, although the best public relations at the time masqueraded as scientific dispute.
What's the thesis of this book, then, that companies who manufacture chemicals and other exposure-related things have spent time and money to convince us that they're not bad for us?
The message of the book is that in the past, companies have often kept us from having information. For example, if people complain about a problem and you move them out of their town and homes and you say, we'll give you $37,000, but you can't talk to anybody about any health problems again, that's one way of managing information.
Did we miss the signs of exposure-related cancers, or was our attention willfully misdirected?
The answer is both. Sometimes we did miss signs, but sometimes our attention was willfully misdirected. My position is this. It's the wrong question to ask. Do we have proof of human harm? If we say, do we have proof of human harm, then we're saying, let's take those things where we have enough sick and dead people, like asbestos and benzene, and let's estimate how many other people are exposed to those and calculate what the burden is on workers for cancer. I think that's the wrong question. The question should be, what are the things we have good reason to suspect are going to increase our risk of cancer now? And what action should we take to reduce that threat while we continue to do the research on human evidence?
When you go and talk to people who run the companies that use benzene in their industrial processes or have waste dumps that are toxic or otherwise polluting, what do they tell you when you say, you know what, we really need to get you on board and help us figure this out?
I'm starting that conversation. And I am encouraged by the fact that some of the leading businesses in the world understand that they're going to have to do it better. And I think that we're really poised. We have reached a critical point at this time. It's clear that we have made tremendous progress in treating and finding cancer. And that's what Nobel Prizes have been awarded for, understandably. But it's also clear that we can't continue operating in the same old way. As Einstein said, you cannot solve the problems of the future with the technologies of the past that created them.
Deborah Davis is the director of the Center for Environmental Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute. She's also the author of the book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer. Ms. Davis, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, shutting off the tap for South Africa's poor.
They are lending monies on conditions that they privatize very important and vital basic services.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 34 points, a quarter of 1% to close at 13,912. The NASDAQ edged up 10 points, about 0.4% to 2709. The S&P 500 up 5 points, 0.4% there, 1531 the number at the bell. Some analysts warned the worst was yet to come in the housing industry, but the prospect of another interest rate reprieve sent KB Homes up 2.5% today. Sallie Mae got a ratings bump up to outperform, which spurred its shares up by more than 9%. Bear Stearns pushed the market up yesterday on reports that Warren Buffett was buying into the company, but it took a 1.5% slide today after the Oracle of Omaha said that ain't necessarily so. Oil prices dragged down the overall market and the economy a little bit. Oil companies fared well, though, today. Exxon up 0.6%. Chevron rose more than 1%. Bonds climbed. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.56%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bank of America, believing that healthy communities and a healthy planet are essential to creating opportunities for everyone. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity. And by Siemens, from strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for August. Michigan University releases its consumer sentiment survey for September. And Valentine's Day is months away. To tide you over, why not send your honey some romantic thoughts tomorrow on Love Note Day? Like a Valentine, but not. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know all those forms you fill out when you start a new job? Most of them end up in a file drawer someplace, but at least one of them, the W-2, finds its way to the Social Security Administration. There, Social Security numbers are compared, and if a new employee's number doesn't match what's on file, the SSA sends the company what's called a no-match letter. Thousands of those letters were due to be mailed out a couple of weeks ago as part of the Bush administration's crackdown on illegal immigrants. Labor unions filed suit to stop them, and a federal judge will consider the case in a hearing next week. Ashley Milne-Tite reports industries and livelihoods hang in the decision.
It's a busy weekday lunchtime in the cramped kitchen of Good Enough to Eat, a Manhattan restaurant specializing in home-baked goods and comfort food. Cooks and busboys jostle with each other, chopping lettuce and maneuvering to dump dishes in the sink. All the guys in the kitchen are immigrants. Owner Carrie Levin has received no-match letters from the government in the past. In response, she's fired workers who've used dodgy social security numbers. She's not looking forward to getting more letters in case she discovers that some of her current employees' numbers are fake.
Maybe we're going to get another five or six more people that their number doesn't coincide, they're going to have to go.
This summer, the Department of Homeland Security announced that when the next batch of letters goes out, business owners need to act fast. They'll have to resolve any discrepancies with a worker's social security number within 90 days or get rid of the worker. Otherwise, they could face fines of up to $10,000. Levin dreads the idea of letting anyone go. She says most of her staff has been with her for years, and she says good employees are hard to find.
It took me 8 months to find somebody to work with me in the kitchen. This is a problem. This is a really big problem.
Chuck Hunt is with the New York State Restaurant Association. He says Congress has failed in its job to sort out the immigration issue, and as a result, business owners are stuck with an unwelcome burden.
They're asking us to be border control officers right in our restaurants.
But some critics say that's exactly what business owners should be. Stephen Camerota is with the Center for Immigration Studies. He says 50 to 60% of illegal immigrants give employers some form of social security number. Most are made up, he says, or consist of a string of zeros. He says the whole system needs an injection of integrity and employers should help.
And these social security non-match letters are a good first step. They're one piece in a larger puzzle. But this is a common sense thing that isn't particularly expensive to implement and over time could be very disruptive to the employment of illegals.
And he says gradually force them to go home, something this undocumented restaurant worker says he's pondering.
My name is Gabriel and I work in a restaurant as a busboy.
Gabriel is 24. His mother brought him and his sister to the U.S. when he was 11. No one in the family is here legally. He has a taxpayer ID, which he enters on employment forms, but he's always fudged the issue of a social security number. He's concerned about the looming clampdown, but he's not convinced it'll stop people like him from seeking jobs.
These people are hardworking people who really care about their family. They want to have food for the table. They want to have a ceiling for their children. They would do anything to keep working.
Including, he says, continuing to get creative with the information on job applications. But these short-term fixes might not hold up under Homeland Security's new enforcement efforts. If they don't, Gabriel says he may have to start a new life in the small Mexican town he left as a kid. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
No match letters are one approach to sorting out the tricky issue of immigration, but there are surely others. If you have an idea, tell us about it. Head to marketplace.org and visit our idea generator. President Bush has had a busy day. He signed that student loan bill we mentioned. He ordered the Treasury Department to impose new economic sanctions on Burma. And he hosted a meeting of major polluting countries today. Among the critics there was South Africa's environment minister, who suggested the president's proposals don't really solve the problems of global warming. Water scarcity is one of those problems. Using new water meters, South Africa's found a way to put conservation and commerce on the same page. But Gretchen Wilson reports human costs don't appear on the bill.
The government launched Operation Save Water in this neighborhood 4 years ago. Households get 6,000 liters, or about 1,600 gallons, of water free every month. The electronic meters are like this one at Jennifer Mokotsane's house.
Yes, our water meter.
It switches off the water once the free limit is reached, unless she buys credit at a municipal office in advance. And that's the problem.
So we'll be running out before the end of the month. It's so difficult.
There are 8 people in Mokotsane's household. No one's working, and they live on a monthly pension of $115. They can't pay an extra 10 bucks a month for water. So they ration what they get for free, 6.5 gallons per person per day. Everyone uses the same bath water. They use the water from washing dishes or doing laundry to flush the toilet. Even then, they run out, so they steal it.
Sometimes we would go sneak at night. There's a gate in my neighborhood at the opposite angle. I would sneak in at night and go and steal their water.
Commodifying water has quite literally created an underground economy. Some outlying neighborhoods aren't yet metered and have started selling water from outside taps. That's where Ntabiseng Ntambani pays to do her laundry.
You can wash as long as you like because they don't have prepaid water meters, but you'll do that for money.
About 80 cents to wash bed linens or diapers, or $1.50 to fill a garbage can to take back home. Zorwa Makosi defied pressure to sign up for the water system, so water authorities cut off her toilet. She hired a plumber who found a way to connect all her pipes. Now she has the only tap that won't get cut off, and she lets neighbors take water for free. That's made her very popular.
That side, the water is too much expensive. Everybody is coming here.
Johannesburg Water says the $60 million project has saved billions of gallons of water. But poor residents here say they're carrying a disproportionate share of that conservation. Big industries aren't curbed at all, and some here work as gardeners and maids in homes in the posh suburbs. They see the extravagance of the elite.
We, poor as we are, have to subsidize the very rich people who are wasting water because they have jacuzzis, they bath, swimming pools, whereas we have to suffer.
Mokotsane is one of 5 Piri residents who are taking the government to court in December. But she blames the IMF and the World Bank for supporting water privatization.
They are lending monies on conditions that they privatize very important and vital basic services.
Protests in South Africa's poor neighborhoods have thwarted the system's rollout. That's happened in dozens of countries, from Bolivia to Ghana, that have implemented similar privatized water schemes. And the French company Suez has been at the forefront of some of these initiatives. Misha Kladi is with the Coalition Against Water Privatization. He's cutting out handwritten flyers about an upcoming meeting on resisting water meters. Kladi teaches people how to jerry-rig and bypass them.
We are calling it Operation Vulamaz, Operation Enjoy Free Water, Operation Open the Water.
Even though it's illegal, he says he's just taking back a basic human right.
We are prepared. Even if they want to arrest all of us, they can do that. But at the end, they'll realize that, they'll end up arresting the entire nation.
Kladi and his family have faced police threats. But when you're fighting for water, you can't surrender. In Piri, South Africa, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, things have been looking pretty dismal in the world of television ratings. Count the internet and hundreds of new channels as the prime culprits. But networks do have to keep the advertising dollars rolling in somehow, and now they're going to have a better way to do that. Nielsen, the ratings company, has announced plans to triple the number of viewers it uses to come up with its ratings numbers. At the moment, about 12,000 homes have what are called Nielsen people meters. 4 years from now, that's going to be up to 37,000, which shakes out to about 100,000 people deciding how much advertising will have to pay and what kinds of shows the rest of us get to watch. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow rose 34 points, 0.25%. The NASDAQ gained 10 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 added 5 points. That's 0.4% there as well. Our editors include Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker. Coming up next time on the program, elk lodges are the new thing.
It's about being an elk, cheap beer and community service. And by the way, in that order.
In that order, of course. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.